Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Welcome to Healthcare Today. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers. October has come to be known as Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but the reality is that every day should be breast cancer awareness. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among women in the United States, with 1 in 8 women will develop some form of breast cancer in their lifetime. It's also the most common form of cancer worldwide. A man's risk of breast cancer is lower, approximately 1 in 833. In the United States, mortality from cancer ranks second among cancers behind only lung cancer. In women under the age of 45, breast cancer is more common in black women than white women, and black women are more likely to die of their disease. There is some good news. Breast cancer mortality overall is decreasing in the United States, and this trend began in the early 2000s, possibly because of increased surveillance and decreased use of hormone replacement therapy, as well as effective new treatments. We're going to hear about this and more from our guests today. I'm very honored to welcome Dr. Amy Commander and Ms. Tiffany Hogan. Dr. Commander is, they're both on the phone with us, by the way, from Massachusetts. Dr. Commander is an oncologist who is the co-medical director of the Massachusetts General Cancer Center in Waltham, Mass. She serves as the director of breast oncology and cancer survivorship in the Mass General Cancer Center in Waltham and at Newton Wellesley Hospital. She is an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She herself graduated from Harvard as an undergraduate, took a master's degree in neuroscience at Harvard, a medical degree at Yale University School of Medicine, internal medicine residency training and HEMONC, hematology oncology fellowship training at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and the Harvard Medical School. Ms. Tiffany Hogan is the director of the Speech and Language Lab at Mass General, and she has worked with Dr. Commander at Aspen as a patient. I want to welcome you both.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction. This is Amy Commander speaking. We're so grateful to be guests on your program today.
Well, let's talk about breast cancer. It's hard to know where to start, but I think always a good place to start is in detection. How do we detect or how do we discover breast cancers?
That's a great question, and I agree that's a great place to start this conversation. As you noted in your introduction, breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women in the United States, of course, after skin cancer. And 1 in 8 women in the United States will develop invasive breast cancer over the course of her lifetime. Thankfully, since the 1980s, we have a way to screen for breast cancer, and that's when mammograms were introduced. And it's really amazing to think about, you know, we've had mammograms since the 1980s, and since that time, there's been a significant reduction in mortality or dying from breast cancer due to the introduction of mammographic screening approximately 40 years ago. Certainly, the improvements in outcome for breast cancer are also related to our exciting advances in treatment, but mammographic screening or early detection plays a really important role. So for your listeners, I'd say if I have one message for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, if you are eligible for your mammogram and you know you're behind because of the pandemic, life stressors, et cetera, please schedule your mammogram.
Let's talk about a little bit more about mammograms, because there has been some controversy about when mammograms should start, how often they should be done, and when they in a woman's lifetime they should perhaps begin to stop.
That's another excellent question. And I would encourage your listeners, you know, all women should, first of all, be aware of personal family history on both the maternal and paternal side. Family history certainly is very important when thinking about a woman's risk for development of breast cancer. But I should note that only approximately 15% of breast cancers are really secondary to, genetic factors due to family history. 85% of breast cancers occur in women who do not have a family history. So screening is really important for all women. You asked me about what age should women start, and that's actually a controversial point amongst our medical societies. Depending on which organization you look at, there are some varying ages that are suggested. In general, I recommend that women consider the role of screening with their doctor starting at age 40, and depending on a woman's risk factor, she may start her screening at that age. If she truly has no risk factors, the American Cancer Society would recommend starting at age 45. So it really is a conversation between a woman and her doctor to assess her individual risk and determine the appropriate time to start.
And how often should women continue to get mammograms?
That's another great question. And again, the different organizations may have somewhat different recommendations, but certainly if a woman starts her screening at age 45, we would recommend annual mammographic screening. So that means once a year. And I know in an earlier question you asked, what age should women stop? And, you know, we don't have great data for the role of screening for women over age 74 in this country. So that is also a conversation between a woman and her physician, you know, taking into account her overall health and other medical issues. And if a woman at age 74 is in excellent health, it seems very reasonable to continue mammographic screening. But at that point, one could have the conversation of doing it perhaps every 2 years instead of every year.
You know, you've mentioned, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say women who maybe do have a strong family history or other risk factors, or perhaps maybe, you know, at risk for having a genetic mutation that increases risk for breast cancer, which would really be dependent on family history. Sometimes we also do MRI studies for screening as well. So some women do require more intensive screening than just a mammogram. Sometimes there's a role for an MRI as well.
You mentioned a couple of times now that different medical societies have different recommendations, and I know that that is very confusing for primary care providers and perhaps some of the specialists. Why can't these different organizations sort of come to some consensus?
That's a really great question, and certainly, you know, the data has been reviewed, and there's lots of different meta-analyses that are looked upon to help figure out, you know, what is the appropriate age to start and stop and how often. And I like to boil it down to some general themes just for your listeners. Starting at age 40, a woman should discuss her individual risks and benefit of screening mammography and what age to start. Should that be at age 40 or age 45? And then certainly starting at age 45, I would recommend an annual mammogram. And then between ages 55 and 74, certainly an annual mammogram would be appropriate, but some organizations would say to consider doing it every 2 years instead of every 1 year. And then, as I stated earlier, once a woman is age 74, she should discuss her individual risks and benefits of screening with her doctor, depending on her other medical issues.
One of the reasons why some of the organizations recommend perhaps less rigorous screening is because of concern for overdiagnosis. In other words, and we've seen this in the perhaps even more. We talked about prostate cancer a month or two ago, where sometimes the detection can detect a slow growing or very early breast cancer that. Or a false positive would be even more more likely, where there's something there that might cause a woman great anxiety and perhaps some invasive diagnoses but turns out to be negative. How do you counsel women about that, about the risk of a false positive?
That's a great question. With modern imaging techniques such as the introduction of 3D mammography, often known as tomosynthesis, this type of mammography, which is used in most centers now, really gets an even more accurate picture of the breast tissue and has certainly resulted in better identification of cancers versus benign findings, and is certainly leading to hopefully a lower incidence of false positive rates and unnecessary biopsies. So our radiologists have really made great strides in the technology for mammographic screening over the past few years. So hopefully the incidence of these kinds of false positives is going down.
In your experience, is the anxiety that women feel after a false positive disabling for them, or is there just a tremendous sense of relief when it turns out to be negative?
I would say that in my experience, it's more the latter, the tremendous sense of relief. I think most women that I care for are just grateful that there's a dedicated radiologist who's reviewing her images and trying to make cross every T and dot every I and make sure everything's okay. And I think most people would, most of the patients I work with are very grateful for the opportunity to undergo mammographic screening and have it covered by insurance, and really recognize that screening mammography has been shown to reduce the odds of dying from breast cancer and facilitates use of effective treatment. And therefore, I think certainly our screening tools outweigh that risk of, increased anxiety from a false positive.
Yeah, I would say that along with colonoscopies in appropriate cases, mammograms and colonoscopies are the two surveillance screenings that have had the biggest role in decreasing cancers. You mentioned insurance, and we talked about different organizations recommending different scheduling for mammograms. Which recommendations do insurance companies tend to follow? I mean, if a woman wanted to have a mammogram every year, would her insurance company possibly tell her they would only pay for it every other year?
In my experience at present, we have not run into any issues with a woman obtaining coverage for an annual mammogram, for screening purposes. Certainly when it comes to, I mentioned earlier, MRI screening, which may be indicated in certain situations, there really are specific guidelines of which women would benefit from an MRI for screening. So insurance companies may come down a little harder on that, maybe for good reason. But when it comes to mammograms, thankfully those have been covered, and we're grateful for that.
Let's talk about breast exams, because that's something that women can do on their own, or it can be done in a primary care office or GYN office during an annual exam. But there has been some controversy about that as well. Can you talk a little bit about the value and perhaps the drawbacks of breast exams?
That's a great question. So when you look at studies, we are very much driven by data. That's how we make medical recommendations. So when it's been studied, what is the true value of women doing their own self-breast exam in terms of identifying and picking up an early breast cancer? The studies would suggest that there really isn't a proven benefit of women doing their own breast exams, once a month. But, I also tell my patients, though, you should examine your breasts at least once a month just to know what your own body feels like, because certainly anecdotally, I have many patients who did, feel a lump, which led to their diagnosis. And I think it's important for all women to be their own best advocate and aware of what their body feels like. So if something does feel a little bit off, she can bring it to her doctor's attention. But if you want to go by the data would suggest self-breast examination is not the most useful tool and is definitely not a substitute for mammographic screening.
And for women who are still menstruating, what period of time of the month do you recommend the breast exam?
That's a great question, too, because we know that the breast tissue can feel differently during different times of the month, depending on the menstrual cycle. And I don't know if there's a specific time that women should do it, but it's really hard to answer that. But I think it's just important for women to be aware of what their breasts feel like. So if something ever was new, like a new lump or bump or something like that, she would know that, gee, maybe I should get this checked out by my doctor.
You mentioned a few moments ago the effects of the COVID pandemic, particularly in terms of delaying surveillance. We'll talk a few minutes about how it may have delayed treatment. But in terms of the mammograms, are we seeing an increase in more advanced cancers, possibly because of people missing a year of mammogram?
Right. So this is an area that's really important to discuss. You know, as we know, in March of 2020, you know, the U.S. government declared a national emergency secondary to halt the spread of COVID. And at that time, all non-essential care was, you know, delayed, including mammographic screening. So, you know, for the spring of last year, screening for breast cancer declined by well over 90%. And then certainly once mammographic screening ramped up again, you know, in the late spring of last year, you know, there was still a lot of reluctance and fear for people to come into the hospital for routine medical care, which I think we're still seeing that. There's numerous challenges in terms of individuals proceeding with their mammographic screening and other screening tests, whether they're fearful of coming to the hospital, whether they can't get into their primary care doctor to get the test scheduled. Many individuals, unfortunately, have lost their jobs or maybe don't have health insurance, or there's other barriers to care. So these are all areas that are really important to work on. And certainly the American Cancer Society has a major initiative underway to help individuals get back to screening and increase awareness about the importance of screening, not just for breast cancer, but of course for, you know, colon cancer and cervical cancer as well. So you're asking a great question. Are we seeing more, you know, later stage cancers with potentially worsening prognosis? And I think that is definitely the fear that we may be seeing, you know, that this delay in diagnosis may lead to presentations with, you know, more later stage disease with poor clinical outcomes. And certainly we'll see what the data shows in terms of that. But anecdotally, I have many women in my own practice who will acknowledge they did not get their mammogram last year for a multitude of reasons.
Well, I can certainly say from my own hospital that every effort is being made to create a very safe environment, and the benefit of getting those mammograms far, far, far outweighs whatever infinitesimal risk might be from putting on a mask and going into the mammogram screening area. So we would encourage women who are due for their mammograms, please get them done. I want to remind listeners, if you have any questions or comments, if you've been a breast cancer patient or have loved ones who have been, please give us a call at 802-244-1777. That's 802-244-1777. Before too much longer, I want to bring in Ms. Hogan, and we'll just focus for a minute on diagnosis. I understand that, am I correct that you were treated for breast cancer?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us just how your breast cancer was diagnosed?
And it's really in line with all of the concerns and questions you've had so far. I am a busy mom of three, and as you said, I run a lab at MGH. I have a aunt that has passed away from breast cancer, so I was acutely aware of getting my mammograms every year starting at 40. My annual mammogram was scheduled for March 22nd, 2020. Well, that didn't happen. It was canceled. And so I had it on my mind, but with the COVID closures and children being home, it was a busy time. So I ended up going to my primary doctor in September of 2020. And she did a regular breast exam, and she didn't feel anything. And she said, you know, I noticed you're behind in your exam. You should go get it. And I said, well, you didn't feel anything. And she said, I said, can't I wait till March 2021? And she said, no, please do not wait. You need to go right away. And she did not let me leave the office until I scheduled that mammogram. And thank goodness she did, because I had the mammogram exactly a year ago yesterday. So it was October 14th, 2020. And they found a very small lump, and it was behind the nipple. So it was not something that was readily felt in a routine exam. So I'm very grateful that she made sure I got that mammogram, because if I wouldn't have, you know, I happen to have a type of breast cancer that's aggressive, moves quickly. You know, I think even waiting that extra 6 months would have made a difference in my staging. So I started treatment. I was with MGH, very lucky to get in, lucky to be with them, and they move quickly when you find a cancerous lump. So I saw the doctor, you know, October 22nd. I started chemotherapy October 29th. I had chemotherapy for 3 months. It was really tough with COVID because back then we didn't have vaccinations, and so I was immunosuppressed. So my children stayed home with me. My husband, we were able to take some medical leave and just hunker down. I had chemotherapy, then I had a lumpectomy, then I had more chemotherapy, and then I had radiation. So I just finished treatment on June 8th, so not too long ago, and I had the pleasure of being in Dr. Commander's wellness group to talk about how to handle after breast cancer. So my story, I think, is a breast cancer story that's right in line with the COVID time.
Well, it certainly is. That is exactly what we were just talking about, isn't it? Dr. Commander, let me ask you, once a woman has a positive mammographic finding, or if a lump is found, what are the next stages in diagnosis?
Right. So as you know, as Ms. Hogan just stated, really the next step is often to see a breast surgeon, because the breast surgeon is really the first doctor to evaluate the mammographic findings and pathology and discuss the surgical options with the patient. I will say at the Mass General Cancer Center, we very much pride ourselves in multidisciplinary patient care. And what does that mean? So breast cancer is actually treated by a team. There's the surgeon, there's the breast oncologist, which is what I do. There's a radiation oncologist. And then, of course, our other team members are so key: genetic counselor, social worker, psychologist, nutritionist. I can go on and on with all the wonderful colleagues I work with to care for my patients. It really is a team approach. So often a new patient will be seen by a breast surgeon along with a medical oncologist and radiation oncologist to formulate the most appropriate treatment plan for that individual patient.
We're going to talk about treatment. We'll have a break in a few minutes, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about treatment after the break. But so you have a woman, or on rare occasion a man, who has been diagnosed with breast cancer through radiologic testing and a biopsy. There's a lot of decision making that still has to happen in terms of treatment. And I think it's much more complex than it was, say, 30 to 40 years ago. We've talked about this a year ago when we focused on breast cancer. Used to be a major radical mastectomies were the treatment for any and practically all breast cancers, but the times have changed. And so when you sit down with a patient and with this extensive team that you have at Mass General, how do you decide on treatment?
Great question, and obviously, you know, complicated. It really depends on so many factors, as you've stated. Thankfully, we've made so many advances in how we treat breast cancer, even over the past 5 years, that, you know, it really requires a multidisciplinary conversation between the various specialists, really taking into account some key things. What type of breast cancer does this patient have? So breast cancer is not one disease. There's many different subtypes of breast cancer. And the first way we figure that out is looking at something called the receptors of the tumor. Is this tumor sensitive to the female hormones, estrogen and progesterone? Many breast cancers are indeed sensitive to these hormones, but some breast cancers are not. So that's one factor that's really important. And then another marker we look at is something called HER2, or HER2. And about 15% of breast cancers in the United States overexpress this marker. And that's another really important feature of a breast cancer that needs to be noted at diagnosis, because that very much helps guide treatment decisions in terms of, does a patient need some type of chemotherapy or targeted therapy before surgery, or should she go straight to surgery? So there's, as you can see, there's multiple conversations about when should surgery happen, what other therapy does the patient need, will radiation be required? And a lot of this really depends on the features of the tumor, the size of the tumor, et cetera.
Last year we had a breast surgeon on as one of our guests, but and I know that you're not a surgeon, but just in terms of surgical approaches, We now have a decision between lumpectomy and a much more extensive, either partial or total mastectomy. How is that decision generally made?
Right. So as often as we can, we certainly, you know, want our patients to be able to preserve their breasts if possible. So that's when a lumpectomy comes in, and that's when a surgeon is able to remove the primary tumor and leave the rest of the breast intact so the patient, you know, keeps her breast. And that's certainly the the preferred mode in many situations. And in that case, a woman would require radiation therapy down the road as well if she has something called a lumpectomy. In some cases, a mastectomy may be required, though. That really depends on the size of the tumor. If it's a larger tumor and, you know, the surgeon feels that she's going to need to remove a very significant amount of breast tissue to, you know, get that out, you know, that's when a mastectomy may be indicated. Or let's say a patient does have a very strong family history of breast cancer and may also have one of those genetic mutations I mentioned earlier.
I apologize. I'm going to have to actually stop you in mid-sentence because we are going to have to go to a break. We are coming back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay with us. So, Dr. Commander, we were talking briefly about surgery, and certainly the good news is that breast cancer surgery has become far less invasive and reconstruction surgery is much more advanced. In terms of the treatments that you provide, which is medical oncology, you mentioned that there are, I guess, decision trees, one of them being receptor positive or receptor negative. Some of those receptors are certainly estrogen receptor, and then you mentioned the HER, HER2 receptor, which was discovered more recently. Are there other genes or genotyping that you can do to predict a woman's potential course and how aggressive therapy needs to be?
Definitely. We've seen such exciting strides in how we treat our patients in the past 5, 10, 15 years. So one test that comes to mind is, let's say a patient goes to surgery first, so she has her tumor removed. If that tumor is estrogen receptor positive and measures greater than 1 centimeter on review of the pathology, there is a test called the Oncotype DX test. That's a really neat test. It's a genomic test. So it's a piece of the patient's tumor is sent to a company called Genomic Health that analyzes genes expressed by that tumor to help us get something called a recurrence score, which helps us as the doctor predict, does this patient need chemotherapy in addition to some type of anti-estrogen therapy? Because as I noted, that test is sent for estrogen receptor positive tumors. So the Oncotype test is a test that's really enabled us to personalize treatment for these types of patients and really narrow down which patients truly benefit from chemotherapy.
At the Mass General, do you use that routinely, that genotyping?
Yes. That test is very much standard of care, you know, certainly in Mass General, but definitely in the United States and around the world. The Oncotype, there's also other molecular tests that are used, such as MammaPrint is another commonly used one. But these tests have really revolutionized how we treat patients, and that's specifically for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. So for your listeners, we don't send that test on all types of breast cancer, but for estrogen receptor positive tumors that are around a centimeter or greater, that's when we would consider sending that test.
So you might sit down with a patient and say, here are the results of your biopsy. Here are the results of this genotyping. We feel that you do not need as aggressive therapy. How do people hear that? Are they reassured by that or nervous?
Well, certainly we explain, you know, the rationale for why we sent the test. And we know, for example, that if a patient has a hormonally sensitive breast cancer, meaning estrogen or progesterone sensitive breast cancer, that part of their treatment will involve taking an oral medication such as tamoxifen, which many people have heard of, or an aromatase inhibitor, which is another pill, and taking these medications for at least 5 years significantly lowers risk of breast cancer recurrence and improves survival from breast cancer. So these are really important medications, okay? So when I'm seeing a patient in this setting, though, if she has an oncotype score that's, let's say, you know, a low score, okay, that would suggest that the anti-estrogen therapy is so important that there's really no benefit from adding chemotherapy to her regimen. In contrast, if she had a score that's, let's say, 30, like a higher score, that's when the role of chemotherapy would need to be discussed. So I think our patients are very appreciative of the scientific advances that enable us to really personalize care and these treatment recommendations.
There's something else I should have brought up when we were talking about the biopsying and whatnot, and that's sentinel node biopsies. It used to be that women were routinely, all of the axillary lymph nodes were taken during the biopsy, and that led to a lot of secondary problems, in their lives. Now we have the sentinel node biopsy, which is much less invasive. But if a woman's found to have spread to outside of the breast tissue to her lymph nodes, for example, how does that change your approach?
Great question. So, yeah, the sentinel lymph node biopsy procedure has really been such a major advance in how we treat women with breast cancer, because you're right, it used to be patients required these lymph node dissections, that's what it's called, which is removal of many lymph nodes under the arm, and that could lead to subsequent complications down the road, something called lymphedema, which is swelling of the arm on the side where the lymph nodes were removed. And thankfully, while we do still see that, we're seeing it a lot less, and we're much better at treating it and managing it than we were in the past. When you ask, though, what is the significance of finding cancer in the lymph nodes, that is another feature that we look at when we're trying to determine what other therapy does this patient need. You know, is she a candidate for chemotherapy, and why? And so these are all the factors. That's why, you know, the multidisciplinary team is so important, because we look at the size of the tumor, the receptors I mentioned earlier, has the tumor spread to the lymph nodes. All of these factors play a role in how we determine what other therapy a patient may need.
Ms. Hogan, I want to turn to you for a minute and bring you in, because you've recently gone through this whole process and perhaps are still going through it. Would you like to share a little bit about what your experience has been like?
Yes, I think that I've been very grateful to have the multidisciplinary team. Also, the speed, I think, is critical when you are, you know, when you go through having a mammogram that's of concern, you want to know right away, is this cancer or not? And they move very quickly to the ultrasound and then to the biopsy, and I knew right away. But then once you know and you hear those words, I have cancer, you want to move quickly to determine your best plan. And I didn't realize all the science and advances in breast cancer. So I met with the multidisciplinary team, and I went through a full-day clinic. It was a little trickier in COVID because I couldn't take anyone, but my husband was on the phone listening, and I felt like at the end of the day, I could just breathe a sigh of relief. Even though I knew I was going to go through some intense treatment, I felt that I had the team that I could turn to, and I felt ready to do it.
You have been through...
Can I follow up on something?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I just want to acknowledge something that she just said, and thinking of any listener who's been going through cancer treatment during the pandemic. I mean, this has been such a challenging time for our patients with a cancer diagnosis. As Ms. Hogan just mentioned, her husband was on a phone when she was at her appointment learning about the next steps in her treatment. We really had to limit, you know, quote, visitors for appointments, for chemotherapy, even for surgery. And that has been such a challenge for our patients during this time. And it's taken, you know, such incredible resilience and strength from our patients to be able to move forward without having someone by them side. Like, that's just, I just have to acknowledge that.
And I think in almost any aspect of, certainly people are in the hospital of, with any diagnosis, that was, it's been very difficult, obviously. So, Ms. Hogan, do you want to just share a little bit about what it was like afterwards, going through the chemotherapy and radiation and whatnot?
Yeah, so chemotherapy was really hard. That's kind of the understatement of the year. However, I will say that I was so happy that the chemotherapy I had was targeted for the type of breast cancer I had. I have triple negative, which means that I was negative on those three receptors. And that put me into a different category, subtype. And so then I was able to have a targeted chemotherapy. I had chemotherapy prior to my lumpectomy. And that's something that is can happen for patients. Sometimes you go straight into the lumpectomy and you do chemo later. Sometimes you're able to do it ahead of time. If you do it ahead of time with this targeted approach, it can give you more information. But it was so difficult. But I also had this team I could call and manage side effects. I had support from family and friends, which was critical. I don't think I really understood until I became a patient that breast cancer is something that you don't just get through and then get back to your regular life. It really is a chronic condition, meaning that even though there's no evidence of disease for me after all of those treatments, I still see my oncologist regularly and I still have the fear of reoccurrence. And so, you know, it's really got me thinking more about healthy living, what I can do, and how to live the best life I can. The treatment part, you know, it's traumatic, but you get through it. And, you know, in some ways you're grateful because if I didn't have the treatment, I wouldn't be here. So it was tough.
We're going to talk about healthy living in just a few minutes before we end. But Dr. Commander, Ms. Hogan mentioned she's triple X in terms of negative for those three receptors. That's not a good thing to hear, obviously. And I mentioned at the top that African-American or black women still have higher mortality at younger ages of breast cancer. And I believe it's thought that some of that may be racial disparities in terms of accessing care for sure, but also it may have to do with the triple X. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so triple negative breast cancer, as Hogan just mentioned, is a subtype of breast cancer that occurs at about 15% of breast cancers in the United States. I will say that there's tremendous research being done now to improve outcomes for patients with this type of breast cancer, and clinical trials have been so key, and we're very optimistic and have so much hope that outcomes for these women are going to be so much better, and we're going to be seeing higher cure rates. So I just want to make that point because I know so many smart people are working really hard on this problem of curing this type of breast cancer. But you do raise an important question that, unfortunately, you know, in women who, you know, black women, they are more likely to die of breast cancer compared to white women. And why is that the case? And there could be many factors, as you suggested, perhaps access to screening or other types of explanations. But we do know that the biology of breast cancers in African-American women may be distinct, and we do see more commonly the subtype of triple negative breast cancer, which can have a more aggressive phenotype. So this is another active area of research, and lots of attention is being paid to this now to see how can we find better treatments and improve outcome for this population.
Before we finally get to wellness, I'm going to ask you a loaded question, but I think it needs to be asked. If a woman is going to undergo breast cancer surgery, is it significantly better outcomes if she sees a dedicated breast cancer surgeon rather than, for example, a general surgeon in her community?
Well, that is a tough question because, you know, I am very fortunate to work with a wonderful team of dedicated breast surgeons at the MGH Cancer Center. So that's the world that I know. So, of course, my answer would be, yes, see a dedicated breast surgeon, but I am sure there are many amazing surgeons out there who perform many breast surgeries as well. So I don't want to imply that a woman must see a dedicated breast surgeon, but certainly that has been my experience since I've been working at the MGH Cancer Center. So it's hard for me to comment on the other side.
And what we're hearing is the value of an interdisciplinary team, which speeds the process of diagnosis and treatment and also adds these add-on services, which can be so important for not only the treatment of the disease, but just quality of life. Let's talk about quality of life. I know Dr. Commander and I think Ms. Hogan as well, you're both involved in wellness and in terms of both possibly preventing breast cancer, but also living with the disease. Can you talk about what you've learned and what you would like to share about that?
Ms. Hogan, you go first.
Okay, is this for me? Okay, yes. So I participated in a program. It's a 12-week wellness program by Dr. Commander and colleagues, and we focus on overall healthy living, not just food and exercise, but sleep, social connections, and such. It's so critically important when you're living with the fear of reoccurrence and living with the longstanding effects that you can have from treatment, and also just feeling empowered to take advantage of the extra life you were given and to live that very best life that you can live. So it's been, I think empowerment is the key here because especially with triple negative, you can feel a bit lost when you aren't on receptors medication after treatment, that you want to be able to take control of your health.
Mm-hmm. There's something else too, but I guess we should mention specifically for young women such as yourself, and that is, most of the chemotherapies, if not all of them, are going to put you into early menopause. So not only are you dealing with cancer and the effects of cancer treatment, but you're now in menopause as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That chemo pause, we call it. Depending on your age, the chances you'll come out of that menopause are variable. Mine are about 50-50, so we wait a year after chemo is over to see what happens, but I'm still dealing with those effects for sure, the hot flashes and things that I'm dealing with earlier than I would have expected to.
Well, I think you mentioned the word empowerment a couple of times, and that may be perhaps the most important aspect of this, but Dr. Commander, tell me about your work and research in wellness. By the way, I should mention, if I may, my understanding is that you actually ran the Boston Marathon this past week. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
I was going to say you're such a slacker in terms of all the other work you're doing, and you go out and run the Boston Marathon. But congratulations on finishing it.
And she ran it.
It's all related.
So. Yeah, tell us about wellness.
I will say it's all related. Because as Ms. Hogan noted, in collaboration with my colleague Beth Brady, we started this program called Paving the Path to Wellness for Breast Cancer Survivors, which is really based on empowering women who've been through breast cancer treatment with evidence-based knowledge from lifestyle interventions that have been shown to improve not only quality of life, but also outcome from breast cancer. And physical activity is way up there. So I'm trying to show you I practice what I preach. And I'm proud that I did fundraise for an organization in Massachusetts called the Ellie Fund, which is a nonprofit that actually supports women going through breast cancer. So treatment. So that
thank
was
thank you for doing
fun.
That.
But thank you.
What is it about physical exercise? And obviously, we're not recommending people go out and run the Boston Marathon, but just in terms of some kind of daily exercise, what is it about that helps fight breast cancer?
I mean, that's a really great question and certainly something that's under being studied. We do recommend that, our patients follow sort of guidelines that have been really established by, the physical activity guidelines for all Americans, which is really about 150 minutes of moderate aerobic activity each week, which means walking, cycling, vacuuming your living room does not mean running a marathon, and then strength training sessions at least twice a week. So that's really what the guidelines would recommend. There's probably a multitude of ways that exercise helps breast cancer survivors. Certainly it's important for helping, maintain body weight, but also important in terms of, improving cardiovascular functioning, reducing fatigue, improving mood, helping actually reduce risk of lymphedema. So there's multiple ways that exercise has been shown to be beneficial.
We might also add helps prevent osteoporosis, and we certainly hope Ms. Hogan's going to have a long life. And since she is in earlier menopause, keeping her bones strong is going to be important for decades to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk about diet. And what are we learning about things that may help or perhaps – possibly foods to avoid? People hear a lot of different things, and some of it's not true, I'm sure.
Right. There's a lot of misinformation out there when it comes to nutrition for all kinds of medical issues, as we know. I'd say the number one message, if I was going to state one thing on your program, is really that women need to limit alcohol. I know nobody likes to talk about that, but alcohol actually is associated with many different types of cancer, not just breast cancer, But certainly alcohol use, even, I hate to say it, even, you know, one drink a day consistently over years can increase risk for breast cancer. So I'm not telling people never, ever, ever have a drink, but I think it's really important for women to know that alcohol use really should be limited because, unfortunately, it can increase risk for breast cancer. Plus, it has extra calories, and we know that it's important for all of us to do our best to be at a healthy body weight.
Are there avoiding alcohol certainly may be helpful. Are there other foods that seem to help or potentially harm?
Yeah, great question. So certainly we counsel our patients on the importance of eating lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and certainly limiting processed foods and ultra processed foods, which are all too common in our country, as we all know. So, you know, really avoiding processed foods, added sugars, things like that is very important for breast cancer survivors, and focusing on, again, whole foods like, you know, just fresh fruits and vegetables, honestly, throughout the day, incorporated into every meal. We know that that is the best way for us to get nutrients that our body needs, a much better way than taking supplements that are certainly out there and being marketed to our patients. So eating, I like this quote by Michael Pollan, actually, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. That's pretty much what I would recommend. It's a simple, simple recommendation there.
Ms. Hogan, what have you changed about your life in this past year and going forward? What do you kind of changes have you made?
The changes have been slow and steady. And at one point, I told Dr. Commander that I was feeling a bit down, like, oh, I don't know what's changed. And then I made the list of what's changed, and I had changed 25 small things. And even just 25 small things can add up to really big changes. I think I would become often overwhelmed, and I talk to friends also who say, I'm just overwhelmed with all the changes. But my best advice and what I got through this wellness program was little changes can add up to something big. So just be kind to yourself and have self-compassion and realize that if you want to change something, you don't have to throw everything out. Just slowly change over time. So I slowly changed. I eat much more plant-based. I eat about 5 cups of plants a day, which sounds like a lot, but actually I just added it slowly over time. And I'm just much more aware of my physical activity and what goes into my mouth. It's been a big change, but it took time.
Yeah. Can I ask you this? I don't know how old your 3 children are, but how did you tell them about your situation? How did you and your husband present that?
That's a really great question. My children are, at the time of diagnosis, were age 4, 5, and 15. And so now they're a year older. So I had one thing I did is I turned to a program at MGH, which is parenting around traumatic events. I also worked closely with my counselor and my therapist to decide what is the best way. But what they've shown is it's just best to be completely honest with your children and as optimistic as possible. So I used language, the full language. I told them about chemotherapy, losing my hair, what cancer was. And I bought several children's books. There's some great ones that you can present to children about what cancer is, but just really giving them the most optimistic view of it so you're not causing more stress, but you want to be totally honest with them and transparent about what's going to happen.
Well, we have obviously wish you all the best and great appreciation for you coming on and sharing your story. And Dr. Commander, you've taken an interesting path thus far, going from neuroscience to breast care. In the very brief time we have left, what inspired you to become a breast cancer oncologist?
Oh, well, I think, as you can tell from meeting Ms. Hogan, it's just a wonderful opportunity to connect with amazing women like her and provide care for the whole patient, not just treating the cancer, but treating the whole person and helping women recover after undergoing treatment for breast cancer. And that's been very, very rewarding for me.
Well, thank you also for being on this show. And thank you to Mass General for having this service. I think it's important for Vermonters to know. And we will be back next week, but thank you both.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
As Ms. Hogan herself said, be kind to yourselves and please be kind to others. Talk to you next week.